Good morning, and welcome to the Thursday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. The NHL is not allowing players to compete in the 2018 Winter Olympics. Here's What to Know by Jennifer Kalfas. The National Hockey League will not participate in the 2018 Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea, which means some of the world's greatest hockey players, including Alex Ovechkin and Sidney Crosby, will not be allowed at the Games. The NHL decided earlier this year not to give its players a break during the 2017-18 season to compete for Team USA and other countries, and the issue remains controversial as the NHL season gets underway on October 4th. The move puts an end to the NHL's streak of sending its players to the Winter Olympics for the past 5 games. The NHL's April decision leaves the U.S. to form a team of NCAA college athletes, European-based players, and professionals competing in other leagues outside of the NHL. Other countries who also would have relied on talent from the NHL will have to make other plans as well. Here's what you need to know about why the NHL will not be competing. The NHL's decision to pull out of the upcoming 2018 Winter Olympics came as a result of a series of disputes between the league and the International Olympic Committee, the IOC, over the costs incurred by NHL athletes and who would cover them. The IOC had paid for the travel, insurance, accommodations, and other costs for NHL players, but refused to continue to do so for 2018. When the IOC announced it would not pay these costs any longer, the International Ice Hockey Federation had offered to pay up to $20 million for the costs and insurance for NHL players in an attempt to bring them to the 2018 Games. But that effort did not work, as costs were just a portion of the NHL's concerns with its participation. Top athletes who go to the Olympics in the middle of the NHL season could get injured, which could affect the outcome of the hockey season, the NHL said. Ahead of the 1998 Winter Olympics, the IOC and NHL agreed on a deal that would bring NHL players to the games with their costs and insurance covered by the IOC. The IOC decided to stop covering those costs since the IOC does not do so for other professional sports leagues like the National Basketball Association. The IOC, which distributes 90% of its revenue for the development of sport in the world, obviously cannot treat a national commercial league better than not-for-profit international sports federations, which are developing sport globally, the IOC said in a statement. Covering insurance was an obstacle for the IOC. Insurance for NHL players cost the organization $7 million during the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia, according to the New York Times. Participating in the Olympics is also more of a hassle for the NHL than for other professional sports leagues. In the last few competitions, the NHL took a 3-week break in its season to accommodate the athletes choosing to compete for their countries. Other professional sports leagues, like the NBA, do not have to make the same break in a season, since Olympic basketball events are in the off-season in the summer. What do NHL players think? The National Hockey League Players Association put out a strong statement against the decision in April. The players are extraordinarily disappointed and adamantly disagree with the NHL's short-sighted decision not to continue our participation in the Olympics, the statement read. Any sort of inconvenience the Olympics may cause to next season's schedule is a small price to pay compared to the opportunity to showcase our game and our greatest players on this enormous international stage. Washington Capitals star Alex Ovechkin said he would leave his team to play for Russia because of the ban. However, he since said he would stay with the NHL this season. A number of other NHL players have expressed frustration with the league's decision to pull from the Olympics, according to interviews conducted by ESPN and other news outlets. When asked by ESPN what they would change about the game and why, several NHL athletes said they would allow players to go to the Olympics. Obviously, we all dream of winning a Stanley Cup, and then the next is literally right there, winning a gold medal for your country, Mark Scheifele, the star center for the Winnipeg Jets, told ESPN. Pittsburgh Penguins captain Sidney Crosby, who won Olympic gold medals with Team Canada in 2010 and 2014, told the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette he thought the decision was unfortunate. "I'd love to be there," Crosby told the Post-Gazette. "It's a great experience for everyone involved. Everybody gets up for it. It's too bad that we're not going." Could the U.S. still medal? The historic miracle on ice for the 1980 Olympics, where a ragtag team of amateur American hockey players beat the powerhouse Soviet Union to win the gold medal in Lake Placid, New York, was the last time Team USA won gold. That was before the International Olympic Committee struck a deal with the NHL to include its best players in Olympic competition, starting with the 1998 Olympic Games. With NHL players competing in the last five games, Team USA has won two silver medals in 2002 and 2010. In the 2014 Olympic Games in Sochi, the team finished just shy of a medal in fourth place. Canada won gold in 2002, 2010, and 2014. "We expect to compete for a medal, and this will be no different," said Tony Granato, the Team USA coach for the Olympics, according to the Los Angeles Times. Could the NHL participate in the 2022 Olympics? The future of the NHL's participation in the Olympic Games is unclear, since the NHL's refusal to participate so far only applies to 2018. But before the NHL pulled out, the IOC said its participation in the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing was contingent on its participation in Pyeongchang. Here's how you can help the victims of Mexico City's catastrophic earthquake. By Rachel Lewis. A deadly 7.1 magnitude earthquake rocked Mexico Tuesday, causing buildings to collapse across Mexico City and killing more than 217 people. While there's not an estimate on the cost of the damage or what type of aid will be needed, resources will be vital as emergency responders are already working to wade through the rubble to find any survivors. The earthquake, which struck Puebla, a city southeast of Mexico City, during the middle of the day Tuesday, leveled buildings throughout the city, including an elementary school, where rescuers have already discovered nearly two dozen lifeless bodies. Many charities and nonprofits are already on the ground to help with the Mexico City earthquake, and others are coordinating plans on how best to help the victims of the earthquake. Here's a list of some of the charities you can give donations in order to help with those affected by the Mexico City quake. Red Cross Mexico. The Red Cross Mexico has set up a donation page to help the Mexico City earthquake victims. They've also asked people to donate medical supplies and tools. UNICEF Mexico. The children's charity has also set up a donation page. They will be on the ground helping young people to recover physically and emotionally from the earthquake. Topos, Mexico. The charity is a local rescue brigade that was vital to relief efforts for the catastrophic 1985 earthquake that rocked Mexico. They have asked for donations on Twitter for the Mexico City earthquake victims and are accepting payment through online transfer, PayPal, or their website. At the time of writing, the organization's website appears to have crashed. Project Paz. The New York-based nonprofit that works with Latino children teamed up with the El Paso Community Foundation to gather donations for the Mexico City earthquake victims. On the donation page, people can decide whether they'd like to donate to the September 7th earthquake that hit Chiapas and Oaxaca or the September 19th earthquake in Mexico City. Global Giving. The global crowdfunding platform has set up a relief fund for those affected by the Mexico City earthquake, giving the option to donate just once or monthly. They've already raised more than $100,000 of its $1 million goal for relief following Mexico's two devastating earthquakes. The money raised through global giving will be used to buy emergency supplies like food, water, and medicine, as well as provide more long-term aid, according to the company's fundraising page. World Vision. The children's charity is currently organizing and supervising volunteers on the ground to establish support and shelters. They're giving out food and hygiene kits to survivors, and in the coming days will be creating safe spaces for the children impacted by the earthquake. Oxfam. Ricardo Fuentes Nieva, the executive director of Oxfam Mexico, told CBS News that the charity's initial concern is to assist in recovery efforts to help find people that may be trapped under the rubble. They will then help to find shelter for those displaced by the disaster. Their donation page says 100% of contributions will be used for relief and recovery. Save the Children. The charity has set up a relief fund for this week's earthquake and the 8.2 earthquake that shook Oaxaca and Chiapas earlier this week. The contributions will be used on physical and emotional support for children. Inside a Berlin synagogue's first Rosh Hashanah after World War II, by Olivia B. Waxman. When Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, begins on Wednesday night, it will mark the start of an annual period in which Jewish people around the world will take time to reflect on starting fresh in the new year. But few celebrants in modern history have had more cause for such reflection than the Berlin Jews who survived World War II. In 1945, legendary Life magazine photographer Robert Capa was there to document the first Rosh Hashanah service held in the city since 1938, which took place on September 7, 1945, at Frankenlufer, a synagogue that the U.S. Army had helped restore after the Nazis torched it. There, he found a people reconnecting with one another and trying to start practicing their religion openly again in a city that was also in ruins. Kappa would have understood their struggle. Born Andre Friedman to a Jewish family in Hungary, he moved to Germany when he turned 18 in 1932 to pursue photojournalism. After Hitler rose to power, he fled to Paris and changed his name, having been inspired by the debonair director Frank Capra. His background didn't prevent him from covering the war against the Nazis. In 1945 alone, he had spent weeks photographing the ruins of Berlin, parachuted with the 17th Paratrooper Division into the combat zone between the German city Wesel and the country's border with the Netherlands, embedded with U.S. Army's 2nd Infantry Division, and produced a photo essay for Life on an American soldier killed by a German sniper to show the heavy days of fighting around VE Day for the magazine's Victory issue. But that Rosh Hashanah service was a time to document a city in peacetime instead. A photo essay in the October 8, 1945 issue of Life reported that about 500 worshippers attended, including Jewish American and Russian soldiers. Donning a prayer shawl, Private First Class Werner Nathan of Newark, New Jersey, held the Torah, which the magazine explained had been hidden from the Nazis in an underground safe. The congregation's rabbi had been killed during the Holocaust, so an assistant stood in, while the choir was made up of men over 45 years old, as no young singers were left among the congregation's surviving Jews. Word about the service got back to the U.S. even before Life published Kappa's photos. The September 8th edition of the Times-Picayune that year described a mostly elderly congregation that sang the songs of Israel with tear-streaked faces, according to a newspaper clip provided by current volunteers at the 101-year-old synagogue, which has been exhibiting Kappa's photos for the past year. Also in the newspaper clip, local Rabbi Martin Reisenberger thanked one Jewish American soldier in particular, Harry Nowalski, who worked across the street from Frankenlufer, for being instrumental in planning the service. "You have brought us out of shame," he is quoted as saying. Nowalski would have been one of the soldiers working with the American rabbis who were brought over to help restart religious Jewish life in the city, according to Dekel Peretz, one of the synagogue volunteers and a doctoral student of German and Jewish history who gives tours of Jewish Berlin and other city landmarks. But for those looking to start a new life, Peretz adds, there was another important reason to attend the Rosh Hashanah service. For those who thought about immigrating to America and wanted to know what life was like there, Berlin Jews could not only reconnect with one another, but also connect with America. Puerto Rico could be left without electricity for months. Here's What to Know, by Kevin Liu. On Wednesday, Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico directly, landing as a Category 4 hurricane in the town of Yabucoa with sustained winds of up to 155 miles per hour. The storm destroyed hundreds of homes and knocked out power across the island, reports the AP. Ricardo Rossello, the island's governor, has imposed a daily curfew between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. through Saturday to allow for recovery operations. The entire island is now in a total blackout as a result of the storm, with recovery in some parts not expected for an extended period of time. Once we're able to go outside, we're going to find our island destroyed, warned Abner Gomez, the island's emergency management director, according to AP. Here's what you need to know. What happened? Power was gradually knocked out as Maria pummeled Puerto Rico, according to Vox. About half of all customers of the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, or PREPA, the island's sole power supplier, reported a loss of power at 4 a.m. local time Wednesday. By noon, the outage spread to all of PREPA's 1.5 million customers. How could a storm knock out power across the whole island? Puerto Rico's power grid was already in bad shape even before the 2017 hurricane season. PREPA's power plants are 44 years old on average, reports Reuters, in contrast with the industry-wide average of 18 years. The company, which filed for bankruptcy in July, called its own system degraded and unsafe, saying in a fiscal plan released this April that years of underinvestment have led to severe degradation of infrastructure, according to Reuters. According to Vox, PREPA also faces a manpower shortage that, even before this hurricane season, was already impeding its day-to-day maintenance. The general economic situation is also grim. Puerto Rico's finances have been in dire straits for years. The island is yet to emerge from a decade-long recession, and unemployment stands at 11%. Its government entered a process similar to bankruptcy protection in May in a bid to restructure its debt load, currently in excess of $70 billion. How long is it expected to last? The combined effects of crumbling infrastructure, financial woes, and Hurricane Irma's impact mean that restoring power across the island is expected to be a difficult process. It depends on the damage to the infrastructure, Rossello told CNN Wednesday evening. I'm afraid it's probably going to be severe. If it is, we're looking at months as opposed to weeks or days. Puerto Rican officials think that the power distribution infrastructure might be more badly damaged than the power stations, the governor told CNN, adding that power could be more quickly restored if transmission lines turn out to be in better shape than they thought. Why is Hurricane Irma a factor? Parts of the power grid had just begun to recover from the damage caused by Irma, which skirted north of the island earlier this month. At the time, over 1 million users in Puerto Rico lost power, according to NBC News. On Tuesday, before Maria slammed into the island, about 70,000 people were still left without electricity as a result of Irma, CNBC reports. Representative Jennifer Gonzalez Colon, a Republican representing Puerto Rico, told CNBC Tuesday that she has brought up the issue of electric supply with Brock Long, director of FEMA. We were asking him to have more resources in terms of electrical teams that can help us out to solve the situation and recover the infrastructure of the power grid on the island, she said. That is going to be the main issue. Has this happened in Puerto Rico before? Yes. A large fire at a power plant last September caused the island's whole power system to fail and left millions in the dark for several days. That disruption was blamed on PREPA's crumbling infrastructure. Will the U.S. federal government intervene? Rossello has asked President Donald Trump to declare Puerto Rico a disaster zone. FEMA announced Monday that Trump had made an emergency declaration for Puerto Rico, which enabled the agency to coordinate relief efforts. A major disaster declaration would mean an increase in federal resources and programs available for affected areas to recover. But according to Vox, the series of underlying issues with Puerto Rico's power grid means that federal relief funds, if approved by Congress, would only be of limited help in this regard. Why Donald Trump and Emmanuel Macron are the world's most important people this week, by Vivian Walt in Paris. Late Tuesday night in New York, French President Emmanuel Macron texted a friend in Paris giving his self-assessment of his debut speech at the United Nations. "I gave it everything I had, I tell you," Macron texted in response to the congratulations his friend had sent. That friend shared the text with Time on Wednesday morning. Macron ended the message with a common French sign-off, kisses. But giving it everything might not be enough, as Macron makes a passionate plea for international negotiations on climate change, the Middle East, North Korea, and other urgent global matters. That's especially true when set against U.S. President Donald Trump's own U.N. speech, given just hours before Macron's address, in which the president threatened that the U.S. would isolate Iran and obliterate North Korea. Among the scores of world leaders gathered in New York this week for the UN General Assembly, Trump and Macron are perhaps the most curious pair. Both are newcomers who shot to power this year as first-time politicians, and on Tuesday, they made almost back-to-back debuts on the world's biggest global stage. On the surface, the two are a study in contrasts in politics, style, and personality. The hardline America First champion versus the fervent globalist, the lumbering 71-year-old billionaire versus the slender 39-year-old wonky intellectual. But one crucial fact binds the pair, and that fact could be key to the decisions the world leaders make in the months and years ahead. Trump and Macron represent two of only five nations with permanent veto power on the UN Security Council, nicknamed the P5. China, Russia, and the United Kingdom round out the group. That is an immensely powerful clique, one that can potentially sway the rest of the world's leaders into declaring war, imposing sanctions, or block them from taking any action at all. What's more, Trump and Macron are the only two P5 leaders that truly count this week. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping both stayed away from this year's UN General Assembly, where their policies over North Korea, Syria, and other issues are under scrutiny. And although British Prime Minister Theresa May addressed the world body on Tuesday, she is heavily focused on her country's fraught exit from the European Union. That leaves the UN's odd couple, Trump and Macron. In his speech, Trump said he would always put America first and that he expected leaders from across the world to likewise put your countries first. It's a message that runs counter to the consensual give and take that has dominated the UN for nearly 70 years. "It is in everyone's interest," Trump said, "to seek a future where nations can be sovereign," a word he used 19 times in his speech. He railed against North Korean President Kim Jong-un as a rocket man on a suicide mission. He called the Iran nuclear deal, painstakingly negotiated through the UN and signed in 2015, an embarrassment to the United States. Just 2 hours later, Macron stood at the same podium. Without mentioning the U.S. president, he told world leaders that Trump-like nationalism was nothing more than a message of survival of the fittest. In contrast to Trump, Macron tried to carve for himself a role as the world's loudest voice for negotiations on a range of issues, as well as the foremost leader on one of the most critical global problems, climate change. "Our planet is wreaking revenge for the follies of mankind," Macron told world leaders, some of whose countries have been rocked by this summer's onslaught of hurricanes and other natural disasters. Meanwhile, Trump announced in June that he would withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Agreement on climate change, to which nearly every country in the world is a signatory. The agreement was the result of years of UN-led negotiations and aims to maintain global warming at a maximum of 2 degrees Celsius above the Earth's pre-industrial levels. Scientists say meeting this goal is essential to avoid spectacular environmental disaster. Macron, in the most passionate moment of his speech on Tuesday, vowed that the Paris Agreement would remain intact despite Trump's decision. "It was signed in this very room," he said in the UN chamber. "That agreement is not up for renegotiation." In an interview with CNN's Christiane Amanpour broadcast after his speech, Macron said he wanted to convince Trump to come back to the climate agreement and regards it as essential to keep an ongoing dialogue with the American president. There are other issues, too, on which Macron seems determined to try to change Trump's mind, including the Iran nuclear deal, which he told Amanpour he believed was better than nothing. That crucial need to keep Trump on side in international agreements, key to the UN, is one big reason Macron's relationship with him appears increasingly important. Trump was Macron's guest of honor at France's Bastille Day military parade in July. And when Macron landed in New York on Monday, his first stop was to meet Trump at the Palace Hotel in Manhattan. At a press conference on Tuesday, Macron told reporters that Trump is his partner in the fight against terrorism, which has rocked France in recent years. Trump respects a partner who states his positions and tries to convince him, he said, but we have to recognize we have our disagreements. That is putting it delicately. Still, those who've watched Macron say he shares one important characteristic with Trump, his tendency to speak bluntly. They are very different people, says Philippe Besson, a Paris novelist whose new book, A Character Out of a Novel, describes Macron's rise to power. They say things as they are, Besson adds, even if their words are worlds apart. Researchers are now editing genomes of human embryos. By Alice Park. Researchers are finding ever more powerful ways to use the genome editing tool CRISPR. In the latest, a UK group used the technology to remove a critical gene needed for human development in order to learn more about the earliest steps of how embryos form. In a paper published in the journal Nature, Kathy Nyakin, group leader for the Francis Crick Institute, and her colleagues snipped out one gene from the genome of a one-cell, just-fertilized human egg. CRISPR is the most precise genome editing tool scientists have at their disposal, and it accurately spliced out the gene in 80% of the 41 embryos tested. Nyakin focused on this certain gene called OCT4 because previous work on mouse embryos showed that it was an essential gene for development of the mouse. When Nyakin removed the gene in the human embryos, the majority of embryos failed to develop to the 8-celled blastocyst stage after 7 days, a crucial stage from which the essential elements of the placenta and the embryo proper form. Only 19% of the embryos did, which suggests that OCT4 is a critical gene for regulating early development. The study is the first to use CRISPR to learn about the function of a gene by deleting it and studying the effects. Last month, a scientist from Oregon Health and Science University reported the first use of CRISPR on human embryos to correct a genetic defect for a heart abnormality. Nyakin says that her study showing that CRISPR can successfully delete a gene opens opportunities for studying exactly what function genes have. When they're not there, scientists can learn what processes suffer from their absence. In the current study, for example, it's clear that OCT4 is an important gene for helping human embryos develop normally. Not only did the blastocyst not form in the majority of embryos that had CRISPR editing, but there were also differences in the placenta-related cells as well. OCT4's role in placenta development was not known before Nyakin's study. We never would have gained that insight had we not studied the function of the gene in human embryos, she says. The knowledge could contribute to better ways of nurturing embryos created during in vitro fertilization, IVF, and to enhance successful pregnancies. In most IVF procedures now, says Nyakin, only about half of fertilized eggs reach the 8-cell blastocyst stage at which the embryo proper starts to develop. Of those that do make it that far, only half successfully implant in the uterus, and a fraction of those develop further, so that only about 12-13% of fertilized eggs grow beyond 3 months. It's possible that the reason why some of those embryos fail to develop is because OCT4 isn't working properly, and there may be a simple molecular test that could distinguish which embryos are most likely to develop normally. Currently, technicians rely on the shape of the days-old blast assist, but having a more reliable way to determine if the embryo is healthy would vastly improve on IVF results. We maybe could use a test of the protein that the embryos secrete into the media and not manipulate the embryos at all to increase IVF clinical rates, says Nayakin. Other ways the work might be useful in IVF is by identifying chemicals OCT4 is supposed to be making but isn't, or by removing things that the defective OCT4 is making that prevent the embryo from growing. Those advances are still many years away, says Nayakin. First, she and her team are eager to better understand exactly how OCT4 is working in the first days of embryo formation, and they want to further explore how it affects placenta development as well, since that's a new role that the CRISPR embryos revealed. That role is so different from what we would have predicted that it's a super exciting part of the research for me, she says. In the age of Trump, the world needs the United Nations more than ever. By Ian Bremmer. Beyond poetic appeals for universal justice, global support for the United Nations is built atop the assumption that every nation can be more secure and prosperous only in a more peaceful world. The UN has a poor track record of preventing individual crises, but its investments in health and education promote international development in measurable ways, and its agencies continue to limit the human cost of conflict. President Donald Trump sees things a little differently. He may have paid tribute to the beautiful vision of the UN in his first address to the General Assembly on Tuesday, but there's little to suggest he's changed his views of an institution he once derided as, quote, a club for people to get together, talk, and have a good time. As he made clear in his speech, Trump doesn't accept that investment in international peace and development will make his country safer or wealthier. Noting that the U.S. pays the lion's share of the U.N. budget, 22%, he declared that no nation should have to bear a disproportionate share of the burden, militarily or financially. As with NATO, he doesn't oppose the U.N.'s useful work. He just doesn't believe the U.S. is getting good value for its money, and he wants other governments to pay more. Yet on climate change, cybersecurity, public health crises, or other problems without borders, the world needs a convening power to bring decision-makers together. Trump doesn't believe in multilateralism and has no interest in this responsibility. The EU can't do it alone, and China doesn't yet have the global standing. These and other governments need the UN to play this role. In Antonio Guterres, who has been Secretary General since January, the UN has the right person for the job. He's the opposite of Trump. He is analytical rather than forceful. He avoids the political bombast that makes lasting friends and enemies. As the former socialist Prime Minister of Portugal, he embraces the European value of collective decision-making. As a former UN High Commissioner for Refugees, he understands the human cost of the world's conflicts. He has good relations with both the U.S. and China. He has brought a new, much-needed emphasis on transparency to the UN bureaucracy. That won't be enough to reform the dysfunctional UN Security Council, where veto-wielding members force watered-down solutions to intractable problems. Only Kim Jong-un, not Guterres, can force the U.S. and China to work together on North Korea. But on other important issues, the UN offers the best hope for managing global crises in the age of Trump. Facebook VP Deb Liu, how to find a career sponsor. Whenever I discuss sponsors and mentors, people are often confused as to how the two differ. Mentors give advice and make suggestions, while sponsors create career opportunities. Mentors discuss your problems, while sponsors push you to strive for more. Sponsors invest their own reputations to help you grow and develop, and they believe in your potential, often more than you believe in yourself. Having a sponsor can be a transformative professional relationship that can bridge the gap between where you are and where you aspire to be within a company. As someone who's benefited from the support of sponsors and who now sponsors emerging leaders, I want to share why this relationship is critical. Here's how sponsors can benefit women's careers and how you can find someone to sponsor you. How can sponsors help your career? I've had several sponsors, people who believed in me and advanced my career in significant ways. Most of my sponsors started as my manager or my manager's manager. The first was a vice president of product at PayPal. She trusted me, a relatively new product manager, to help lead the integration between PayPal and eBay. That opportunity that enabled me to eventually lead PayPal's eBay product team, even though I had only a few years of product management experience. Time and time again, she opened doors and accelerated my career. At Facebook, one of my biggest advocates was my former manager. He never doubted my potential, even when I wasn't so sure of myself. He invested his time to help me grow, and he gave me opportunities that otherwise wouldn't have been possible. He helped me find my way at Facebook, and I credit a lot of my success to his faith in me. I benefited greatly from these relationships. Now I return the favor and sponsor both women and men. I put their names forward for new opportunities in the office and encourage them to take on roles that they may believe beyond their reach. And at times, I help resolve conflicts or challenges that may stand in their way and give them hard feedback to make sure they see their blind spots. I see my role as a mix of mentor, supporter, and motivator. Why don't more women have sponsors? I know I'm not alone in benefiting from having and being a sponsor. Career sponsorship can increase the ability to land a raise or a stretch assignment by 30%, according to research by Sylvia Ann Hewlett, the author of Forget a Mentor, Find a Sponsor. But Hewlett also found that men are 46% more likely than women to have a career sponsor. Further, a 2008 study by Catalyst, a nonprofit focused on advancing women's careers, found that women are more likely to have mentors than their male counterparts, but mentorship often doesn't have the same impact on an individual's career as sponsorship. Sponsors are more senior in the organization, typically one or two levels up in the organizational chart. They find junior people they connect with and look for ways to offer support, whether that's recommending them for a promotion or advocating for them to get a big assignment. But sponsorship is more than a one-sided relationship. Sponsors can receive recognition within the company for identifying and growing new talent. That means that sponsors often risk their reputation for those they help. Naturally, that means that sponsors look for people who most remind themselves of themselves. Because we know that men make up over 60% of management-level positions, those men are more likely to sponsor other young men. So, how can you find a sponsor? Finding a sponsor can be challenging because it requires mutual trust and respect. It's not something you can simply ask of someone you don't know. 1. Build a relationship. Because sponsors advocate for you, your successes will be their successes, and your failures will be their failures. Find someone you feel comfortable spending time with and respect. 2. Earn trust. They need to trust that their investments in you are warranted. Look for someone you trust, whether that's your direct manager or another employee higher up in the company who you've spent some sort of relationship with. Look for someone you trust, whether that's your direct manager or another employee higher up in the company who you have some sort of relationship with, and ask for advice on how to grow. Show you're willing to hear feedback and acknowledge your weaknesses. Prove that the energy and time they spend on you will be worthwhile. 4. Close the loop. Demonstrate how their feedback changed how you approach problems or situations. And 5, be ready to take on new challenges. There will come a point where your sponsor will give you an opportunity that is beyond your immediate skills. Step up, say yes, and deliver. You'll know if you have a true sponsor if they're pushing you towards new opportunities and stretch assignments. They'll believe you're more capable of taking on new things than you ever imagined. The most frustrating thing for a sponsor is when they create an opportunity for you and you refuse to take it. Instead, embrace the challenge and prove yourself worthy of their trust. A sponsor identifies doors, opens them, and ushers people through them. I'm grateful to those who did that for me, and I look for ways to pay it forward. My hope is that as more women early in their careers seek out potential sponsors, they'll find them among those who have benefited from this relationship. This will ensure we grow the next generation of women leaders. Deb Liu is the VP of Facebook Marketplace. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.